Hello. The Forward Institute, the organization that kindly commissions and sponsors this podcast, promotes ethical leadership. Some of Forward's clients are public or third sector, but many are commercial. Implicit in Forward's work is the idea that unbridled profit maximization can be a problem for organizations and for society. In these troubled times, they would argue, business leaders need to think more deeply about their responsibilities to their staff, to society, and to the planet. Well, this is a widely accepted view, but is it right? My guest today on Forward Vision thinks the best way to achieve progress for all is not to put the brakes on enterprise and profit maximization, but to turbocharge these forces of creative destruction. The moral imperative for him is not to control capitalism, but to unleash it.
Brought to you by the Forward Institute, you're listening to the show that offers a fresh perspective on how to manage change and lead from the front. That's Forward Vision with your host, Matthew Taylor.
So I'm delighted and I have to say somewhat daunted to welcome the historian and writer Johan Norberg, the author of a new book which repeats some of the themes of his earlier very successful publications. The new book's called The Capitalist Manifesto, Why the Global Free Market Will Save the World. Johan, welcome to Forward Vision.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Now, you won't know this, but I think I've interviewed about 150 people on this podcast and its predecessor podcast. I think about 90% of them have been left of center. So it's really kind of interesting to have someone who comes from a different perspective. And as you would expect, given that kind of bias, I'm going to interrogate some of your ideas. But before we get into that, I think it's only fair. And by the way, it's a fantastic, I loved reading the book. You know, I go for a swim most mornings here, Anne, and I have a cold shower. And it was cold shower-esque reading your book. It was a little bit, it made me shiver, but I knew it was good for me.
It's nice afterwards.
Well, I kind of enjoyed it after the initial shock. Anyway, let's not take that metaphor too far because it involves me being naked. Anyway, I think it's only fair to give you an opportunity to take just a couple of minutes to summarize the kind of core thesis of your book.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate that. And how do we do this? And the cold shower in just the briefest executive summary of it. You know, capitalism has been sold short. It seems like not just the traditional left, but also the populist nationalist right have all come to the agreement that now we need the big government to get back in business. We're very concerned about global supply chain, repatriate production and start to subsidize certain industries to reindustrialize and to make sure that we get the right green technology and so on. And I think this is all built on a complete misunderstanding of what market forces have done in the past few decades. In my reading, and what I try to explain in the book, is that wherever entrepreneurs and innovators and businesses have been allowed to be free and adapt and improvise, they have constantly, again and again, saved us from terrible shocks. We've had a financial crisis, we've had the pandemic, we have war in not just Europe, but now the Middle East again. And every time entrepreneurs have rebuilt supply chains, they've come up with new technologies and new solutions to make sure that we don't see the devastating shortages and shocks that we all feared. So even though we've had 20 bad years, we've had all these shocks, all these disasters and war and so on. Yet if we look at objective indicators of human living standards, these have also been the 20 best years in human history. If we look at the decline in extreme poverty, around 130,000 people lifted out of poverty every day over 20 years. GDP per capita has increased by around a third. We've reduced child mortality by around half, meaning that last year, 4 million fewer children died than in 2002. So that tells me that we shouldn't go around fixing things that aren't broken, but rather looking at the real problems. And one of them, I think, is the block, the barriers to innovation and entrepreneurship that we still have.
Yes. And in your book, you take apart a series of critiques of capitalism the argument that capitalism is to blame for climate change and must be held back. I mean, you recognize externalities and that you call for a carbon tax, but you think capitalism is the best way to solve the problems that it's created there. You argue very passionately against kind of industrial strategy. I have to say, having read that chapter, I would pay a lot of money to watch you and Mariana Mazzucato kind of intellectually wrestling each other. It would be the most fantastic entertainment, I think. So yeah, anyone who's listening and who thinks, well, I don't believe that, and comes up with the immediate obvious answers, they're probably addressed somewhere in your book. You've even got a chapter on the idea that capitalism makes life kind of meaningless and makes us unhappy and shallow. So you address all these issues very systematically. So let's start delving into this, Jan. So I want to start with the question in a way that your book starts with, which I don't, in a way, I'm not sure you fully answer, which is why capitalism has fallen out of favor. You clearly think it shouldn't have fallen out of favor. You're bemused by the fact that it's fallen out of favor. But it has, and it's particularly interesting that it has, given that, generally speaking, it is right of center, pro-business people who own our newspapers and non-state funded television stations. So it's not as if the mainstream media turned against capitalism. So what do you think happened?
I think that one thing that happened was that we have this series of disasters and shocks around the world. Economic crisis, war, chaos in the Middle East, the migration crisis, the pandemic. And one thing that we learn from history is when people are frightened by the world, they don't want to go out and be open and collaborate and experiment and innovate. They want to protect what they have. And they want to retreat. On an individual level, it's a fight or flight instinct. I think there's also a societal fight or flight instinct that sets in when we're worried about the world. And I think this is for deep evolutionary reasons. I think this is one of the reasons why we've seen the rise of populism, authoritarianism generally. But I also think it affects open markets and global capitalism. People aren't interested in exciting new explorative ventures when the world seems dangerous. They want to retreat behind walls and barriers. And that's what we see now. And I think that's a very understandable, but also a very dangerous reaction, because this might have made sense 300,000 years ago when the problem was a bad storm or a raiding tribe. But if the problem is global warming or it's a novel virus, then what we need is openness to surprises, collaboration with people even on the other side of the planet. We need global exchange and we need trade. So that's, I think, one of the reasons why it's fallen out of favor, global capitalism. But it's also the reason why we need it more than ever in an unpredictable world. Then we need more eyeballs looking at our problems and more brains go out and find new solutions to them.
Very interesting, Ian, because in a sense you're arguing that fear, insecurity, volatility, these things might be leading to people eyeing up the possibility of some ill-defined alternative to kind of market liberalism. It's interesting because there was an argument in the past that actually it was the reverse. It was that you had the movements in the 60s, the anti-capitalist countercultural movements in the 60s, because in a way, capitalism had done so well. People were so well off. Their material needs were met. And so this enabled them then to kind of search for something else that was missing in their lives. So it sounds like capitalism is kind of subject to critiques, however the world is.
Yeah, we can't win.
Poor capitalists, yeah.
No, but I think there's some truth in both these explanations. Once upon a time, there was stable, routine investment and working hard. And once you reach a certain threshold, you kind of, you're sufficiently wealthy, and he that has satisfied his thirst turns his back to the well, as the old saying goes. But I think this kind of reaction that we're seeing now is what different, because capitalism is different. Capitalism is more associated with openness, with globalization, with experiments and surprises. It's not the old boss. It's something more innovative and entrepreneurial. And that seems dangerous when the world seems like a dangerous place. Just like we have a reaction against globalization and migration, I think we have a reaction against free trade and global market forces. The pandemic is the perfect example. Once the world seemed terrifying, seemed like anything could shut down anywhere. We saw troubles in the supply chains. We had this reaction, we should repatriate everything. We should have it close by. Not necessarily a reaction against capitalism, but we should subsidize our own national capitalists and make sure that we repatriate production of everything that's important, which goes against the old saying. I mean, we never had a saying going, put all your eggs in the same geographical basket and protect it with tariffs for a reason. Actually, the businesses and the countries that did best during the pandemic were those who had fairly complex supply chains because they were used to looking for alternatives and started to improvise once a certain supplier disappeared, certain resources disappeared. Whereas those who had just one supplier in one place faced disaster once this happened. So again, I understand the reaction, but it's a dangerous one.
Okay, so look, having read your book, Johan, there's a few things that I am prone to say in a rather lazy way that I will not say in quite the same lazy way again, at least for a while. But I'm not going to let go that easily of my kind of anti-capitalist tendencies. Another thing I kind of was a bit surprised by in the book, this really isn't a critique of the book. It's almost like I wish it was longer and had done even more because it is great. But you don't talk about democracy much in the book. Now, Martin Wolf has recently written, I think, an important book, which argues that democracy and capitalism need each other, but that they are continuously kind of pushing against each other. And that when we have done our best, when we've achieved the most in, for example, what is sometimes the French call les trente glorieuses, 3 decades after the Second World War, when we both grew the economy, accelerated innovation, and enhanced the kind of social wage, that's when democracy and capitalism were working together. And he would argue, I think others would argue, that's because there was a strong memory of what had happened in the 30s and how things had gone wrong. And then he argues that we've forgotten that now. So I would argue that one of the reasons that the capitalism's in the position it's in is because democracy too is in a frail position. And that what lies behind that is that these two systems have not worked effectively together and actually requires a bit of humility from the champions of both frames, ways of thinking, to each other.
Yeah, and I really appreciate this line of critique against the book, that it should have been longer. I wish my editor had the same ambition. One reason why I focused on economics in this book is that I just wrote another book 3 years ago called Open, The Story of Human Progress, which was more about the open society as such, which is much broader than just the open market. It's also democracy, it's rule of law, it's free speech, and so on. So I didn't want to repeat all those messages. But I do agree with what you're saying. I think this is incredibly important. It seems like we've had examples of capitalism, and in a way, there are state capitalist version in China right now without any trace of democracy and the open society. And it's horrible. But it's also the case that democracy does not seem to be able to thrive without this kind of economic freedom in the economic realm. So they are associated, even though they sometimes push up against each other. And it is important that we defend them both and that we make sure. And I think it is a positive circle or a negative circle or a spiral right here. It's a positive one if more people are included in society, get a say, get a stake in that society, and also think about it more long term in the kind of rewards that it'll get, not right now, but later on. And that's what large scale and long term investments in innovation in the market sphere does. And once that happens, more people will feel included and as part of the democratic society. But once one of these break down, there's a risk of a negative spiral.
Yes, and I think that you rightly kind of critique the kind of sloppy use of terms like neoliberalism. But I think in the critique of neoliberalism is a sense that what the kind of leaders of post-war capitalism kind of understood implicitly was that for capitalism to have the freedom to continue to be creatively destructive, to provide returns and wealth for entrepreneurs, it had also to ensure that it met the John Rawls criteria. As Rawls argues, inequality, capitalism, which does have tendencies to drive inequality to a certain extent, is fine as long as it's improving the lot of everybody in society. And so that kind of Rawlsian view that says, yeah, let things rip as long as you meet this criterion that everybody is benefiting, that in a way, the kind of new right philosophy abandoned that. It kind of said that it doesn't really matter anymore. And added to that, I remember hosting a speaker from OECD at the RSA, my former employer, and she said, look, when we looked at the aggregate statistics in the 80s and the 90s, what we failed to do was to look below those statistics. What we failed to see was the communities that were being completely left behind, the old industrial belt, older skilled male workers. We failed to understand what they were going through. So do you accept any of that, Johan?
I accept some of that. I don't accept all of it. And the reason why I don't accept all of it is that I think that built into at least my vision of free markets and free trade is the idea that the best way of accomplishing Rawlsian criteria, basically, is growth, is to achieve more tomorrow than we do today. You know, one of the examples in my book, just a back of the envelope calculation, is that Sweden, when we started to industrialize in the late 19th century, if we had had a per capita growth rate just a single percentage point lower than we've had since then, an annual per capita growth rate, just a single percentage point lower, doesn't seem much, doesn't seem terrifying. But in that case, Swedes today would be as poor as Albanians on a per capita basis. And if we think of all the differences between Sweden and Albania and what we can, in terms of average incomes, but also in terms of welfare consumption, working conditions, access to care, education, culture, and so on, it shows you that redistribution isn't of primary importance. Growth is. And that's why I'm so incredibly focused on trying to unleash this ability to do something more tomorrow than we do today. But once we do that, and this is where I agree with you, it's not enough just to look at averages or the median, because if some people fall behind, then it's not just a problem to them, but for the entire society. And it's not enough to sort of comfort them by saying that, look, the rest of us are doing fine. You know, when unemployment strikes you, it's not 5%, it's 100% unemployment. And this is where we've all failed, I think, in the past 30, 40 years. We need creative destruction. But creative destruction means not just abandoning the old business models and the failures and make sure that capital is transferred to the successful and competitive businesses. We need to do that. We must make sure that the workers move over there as well. And I think we've seen a terrible lack of imagination when it comes to our welfare policies. We've basically tried to buy ourselves away from the problem by just making sure that we have some sort of welfare and disability benefits. But that doesn't help much if people feel like they're not contributing, they're not needed in society. And that's where we have to be. I think both the left and the right have failed. The right, because they just want to keep spending down. The left, because they just want to keep spending up. We need to be more imaginative when it comes to retraining, when it comes to making sure that people move along with the progress of society.
Yeah, no, really interesting. And I mean, you know, from a British perspective, you know, I believe, and we're now 45 years later, I still don't think this country is recovered from the pretty brutal process of deindustrialization we went through. And it wasn't that deindustrialization wasn't necessary. It was inevitable. But the way it was done, the lack of care, attention, investment, and not just about money, but as you say, about status, about pride, about place, we are still reaping the consequences of that. And also the other thing to say, Johan, is that you're saying what you're saying as a Swede. We in Britain, I think, would love to have the kind of flex security that we associate with Scandinavian kind of welfare regimes. But anyway, that's a kind of different conversation. Let me try a couple of other. I hope you're enjoying this, fending off my critique.
Oh, I am. So please keep it coming.
Yeah. Okay, let me have another example. And these aren't random because I think there's a connection here. So I've done a lot of work on public service, led in the public sector in various ways. And I've written a lot about new public management. Now, new public management, as I'm sure you know, is this movement that kind of begins in the 80s in America, spreads around the world, makes management consultants billions and billions and billions of dollars. And it's all fundamentally based on the idea that you need to bring market discipline into the public sector. You need to have, you know, performance-rated pay and contracting out and internal markets and all of that kind of good stuff. Now, there's really no question it failed. It failed catastrophically. It was incredibly expensive. It was very disruptive. And there's no evidence at all of any improvement in public sector productivity across this decade when these ideas were hegemonic around the world. Now, the reason I think they failed is because the companies, the private sector, when it got involved in public services, wasn't sufficiently respectful of what the public want from public service. So they weren't sufficiently respectful of the fact that public does care about equity when it comes to things like health and education. They weren't sufficiently respectful of the fact that the public is happy for people to make huge profits on the basis of their entrepreneurial zeal, but they don't like huge profits being made from what are effectively monopoly organizations. And so what you did was we tried to introduce market discipline in a way which ignored the context in which it was done. And unsurprisingly, it ended up in some of the most egregious policy failures, you know, huge companies going bust and leaving the state with a bill. We had something called the Private Finance Initiative, which hospitals in Britain are still paying for. What would you say were the lessons of, you might disagree with me that it did fail, but what would you say were the lessons of that attempt to introduce the spirit of capitalism into the public sector?
I think you have a point that sometimes this was very simplified. It was rightly an understanding that we didn't see the increase in not just productivity in the public sector, but also in responsiveness to the demands and changing demands of an increasingly diverse citizenry. But it was a fairly simplified one where lots of people thought that you could just introduce the logic of another kind of system into the public sphere. And that might not always work because, you know, we are looking for different things and we have a different spirit in different organizations, whether you're selling food or candy or whether you're supplying healthcare services or educational services. It's all different and you need some sort of respect, I think, for that. And sometimes with new public management, I think it was just the idea of introducing incentives, just making sure that people are doing something to become more productive, but it turned often into ticking of the boxes version of running these systems and organizations, but also sometimes just playing to the incentives. And it's difficult to set incentives. We don't do that in market organizations like that because it is not just a couple of bureaucrats or politicians who say, you're going to have to do X this many times a week, because then you might neglect something completely different. So that's not how you run a commercial business successfully. You do it by being very responsive to the public perception and consumption of your goods and services. And that includes lots of things. It's related to quality and it relates to long-term sustainability of these goods and services and so on. Just picking one of those things is difficult. That's why I think that when we're trying to make public sectors more adaptive and innovative, and we need to do that for sure, because we will see an endless demand for these goods and services, but we don't have endless willingness to pay for them, and we don't have unlimited resources. I think oftentimes it's better to imitate what Sweden has tried to do rather than just setting incentives in a bureaucratic way and then introducing lots of paperwork, introducing more of individual choice in these systems, making sure that families and patients have more of choice in which kind of school, which kind of health provider are they turning to, because they then look at more things than just one simple, single measurement that we often get in new public management.
Yeah, and I find that really interesting. And in the final part of our conversation in a few minutes, I just want to explore this issue of the kind of balance between different forces in society that is necessary for social progress. But before we get to that, I just one last kind of anti-capitalist thrust in our conversation. And that's really the entrepreneur that you describe in your book. you don't describe people in detail, but the implicit entrepreneur in your book is somebody who invents something. They invent something that people like and that is useful, and they get some money and they invest in making this thing that people is useful and they like, and then they make more of it and they grow a business empire. The reality is that an enormous amount of what goes on in capitalism now has nothing to do with people inventing and making things. It's basically to do with financial arbitrage. And I remember talking to the leader of a business a few years ago, and he was leading a broadcasting business. And I said, oh, it must be fascinating leading a broadcasting business. He just said, well, I spend most of my time discussing financial strategy and how I move money around. I don't really talk about why I came into this business. If I gave you an example, if I was asked to ask people in Britain the most egregious example of business failure, it would probably be water companies that got bought out by various funds who then created huge debts in those companies, paid themselves massive dividends, roughly equivalent to the debts that they took on. And now we have water companies that are completely incapable of investing, and they're going to have to be bailed out by the state or massively increase their prices. So I think it is this kind of financialization, the role of financial arbitrage in capitalism, is one of the things that makes it unattractive to people. Everyone loves the idea of someone inventing something in a shed and getting rich.
Yeah. And I agree that there are some examples of capitalism and profit-seeking that I really dislike as well. And you can point to several versions of financial arbitrage that seem very little productive to me. And I think some of them are regulatory arbitrage. Some AAA-rated versions of investments, you don't need much capital to regulatory purposes to invest in them. So you just try to make sure that whatever you have that's not AAA-rated turns into it and so on. And that's really sad. Then that's a major regulatory issue, I think. But on the whole, we must also realize that the financial system as such is a time machine. It's our way of making sure that those great capitalists that we all like, who innovate and to tweak business models to produce things faster, better, cheaper tomorrow than today, they need to fund what they're doing before they have any revenue. And that's what financial markets do. And one reason why America has been so successful in recent years, compared to Europe as well, in not just coming up with new entrepreneurial business ventures, but also in building its economy, is that it has deeper financial markets, more venture capital, more developed debt and equity markets, which means that the crazy eccentrics in the US, they don't have to go to the big bank and tell them about their bizarre business idea. They can go to a diverse ecosystem of different financiers. And if only one of them believes in their idea, they're ready to go. And I think that's something that's incredibly important to our economies and something that we want more of. Can we get that without having some of that sad, silly financial arbitrage? Good question. You'll have to talk to financial economists about that.
As I say, I think that it's worth exploring why it is that there are certain images of capitalism and entrepreneurship that people, look, nobody minds. I mean, Richard Branson is a bit of an old example, and he probably is massively into financial arbitrage, but nobody minded when Richard Branson became very, very rich because they kind of could see what he was making. But people don't feel the same way about hedge fund managers. They don't feel the same way about people who buy out companies and leverage debt and then run away with it. And this is a point I have made in the past to business leaders, which is you need to be more willing to be critical of the dark side of what you do, to have credibility when you champion the light side of what you do. Yeah, and this takes me to the final thing I want to talk about, which is at the end of your book, you use this sort of fable of the Roman emperor who has two singers that he's listening to, and he wants to decide which singer he's going to bring into the court. And he listens to the first, who's absolutely wonderful, but then drops a note. And so the emperor says, well, I'll have the second singer, because they just assume the second singer must be better than the first. And this is your fable about how anti-capitalists assume, against all evidence, that there is a better system for promoting social welfare than market liberalism. Now, I'm with you on that, but I think there's a second thing that happens, and that is that when we put arguments together, when we put books together like yours, we put the book together as a kind of pushback against things that we disagree with. And it's much harder actually to get published or to draw attention to and attempt to say, well, how do we get the balance right? Your book's a very powerful critique of anti-capitalism. But in our conversation, I hear you say things which make me realize that you do think you need some kind of balance, a balance between state, market, and civil society. I don't think you and I probably disagree that much. I am, after all, a Blairite. What do you think is the foundation for a new progressive liberalism? It's not just that the anti-capitalists are defeated. It requires something more than that to find a new foundation, doesn't it?
I think this is a very insightful point. And my metaphor with the Roman emperor and the two singers, in some ways, I'm creating a dichotomy. There are only two different singers, and the mistake the Roman emperor does is to throw away the first just because he drops a note, and it gives the impression that there are only two options to choose from. And you're right, I'm setting this up as this kind of dichotomy. Of course, it's not. The Roman emperor could have said that this singer is great, but you dropped a note, so we'll give you some singing lessons or whatever we do. We make sure that it gets better. So, and that goes for different economic systems as well, of course. It's not a one monolith and take it or leave it, because only other option is North Korea. Obviously, it's not. And I think that the way I defend free markets and free trade in my book, that is also possible to combine with many different versions of a modern welfare state. My examples come from places like Britain and Sweden, which are obviously welfare states with lots of public investments in not just infrastructure, but health and education and so on. So it's not take it or leave it. It's, look, we should be in agreement on these broader issues. We need a system of international division of labor, of free trade, of competition, because that's the way to keep businesses in check and make sure that they innovate, to make sure that they continue to deliver. And we need economic freedom back home based on private property and rule of law, because that's the way in which we continue to experiment and reward people who take risks and businesses who continue to adapt to new situations. That does not mean that I'm telling you exactly how to run the government and the public sector. And in a way, I'm much more humble there. And I think there should be much more room for international comparisons and best cases that we learn from and continue to improve. Because, and this is something that's, I think, a parallel between the continued improvement, adaptation, and experimentation of free markets and our businesses. We should have the same thing when it comes to the public sector. It's not a fixed a system. It should be something that continues to adapt, continues to improve in various ways.
Yes, and I agree, Ian. And I think that one of the virtues that we have fallen short of is pluralism. And pluralism, for me, is about the recognition not only that the state, the market, and civil society are all necessary for social progress, but that there will always be tensions between them. And indeed, it is the effective management of the tensions between them that should be at the heart of the political project, rather than posturing populism and the rest of the crap that we have to deal with. So, Johan, thank you so much for joining me. I strongly recommend your book. It's, as I say, it's an enjoyable cold shower. Thank you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Every morning I do exercise. It's something I slightly dread. And during it, there are times when I want to give up, but I don't. And it makes me happier and healthier. But we need also to exercise our brains. You know, people say, well, I do Sudoku or Wordle. But to be honest, that's the equivalent of walking the dog to the pub. Much better exercise, I think, is to regularly read well-argued positions that contradict our own cherished assumptions and beliefs. It's something that you might dread. You might find it hard when you're doing it, but you'll feel refreshed when you have. That's real mental exercise. So that's what I did when I picked up Johan's book, and I'm really glad I did so. Goodbye. And if you've enjoyed this edition of Forward Vision, please leave a rating or review in your podcast app. It really does make a difference. Thank you.
The Forward Institute is a non-profit organization with the mission of building a movement for responsible leadership. With a network of global business leaders, the Forward Institute facilitates cross-sector learning, creating space for challenging conversations and exploring the very real dilemmas leaders face. For more information, visit forward.institute.